I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week, an in-depth look at the unprecedented transformation underway in today's China. 25 years ago, the country was an impoverished communist country with an uncertain economic and political future. Today, the Chinese are riding a rocket of growth and influence unmatched in the world. We'll talk with them about this success, about life at home and abroad, and about the contradictions of China's century. We begin this series with two women who have been at the center of change in China. Rebecca Lee is a corporate lawyer who lives at that high-speed level, connecting China with the rest of the business world. Xiaoyu Wang is a student who's been working with those less fortunate in rural China. They're both here to talk about the transformation of their country. Now, we'd like to have you join us. What do all these changes mean for people in China? As capitalism grows in that country, will democracy and other changes follow? And what does all this mean for people here in America? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As I said, two guests today, women both born in China who have lived abroad and are now reconnecting with the land of their birth. We'll meet Rebecca Lee first. She grew up in Chengdu and Beijing before moving to the University of Chicago in the early 90s. In fact, she was the first Chinese woman to graduate from the law school there. She's now with the international law firm of O'Melveny & Myers and joining us on the line from a studio in Palo Alto, California. Rebecca, thanks for coming in.
Sure, Dick. How are you?
I'm very well. I want to know what it was that made you decide to study in America in the first place, back in the early 90s. Do you remember?
It was at that time a very easy decision. Everybody in my generation was thinking about going overseas and just to acquire a broader view of the world and, of course, acquiring higher education. But in my case, I graduated just a year after the Tiananmen Square event in 1989. So that obviously made everybody's decision a lot easier. Everybody was uncertain about what's going on at home, and a lot of my classmates and friends have decided to go overseas.
Now, when you think back to that time, were you thinking then that it was your opportunity to get out of China and stay out, or an opportunity to go to the United States or somewhere else, get an education, and then bring that back to have a better life in China?
Well, it's sort of a combination, but I think in my particular case, it was more of the latter, to acquire the education overseas instead of just to get out of China, because I sort of made the personal decision to go to the U.S. for graduate study before the 1989 event. Mm-hmm. But I think that certainly was on a lot of people's mind.
But you were at the time not sure if you were going to continue on in psychology or go into law school. Is that right?
Actually, at that point, I had thought about law school even when I was deciding university majors, but it really was very a big impact on my decision. You know, the being a Beijing student from Beijing University, as a lot of people in China know, meaning that they have to be. Everybody has a sense of being more than just a student, being more than just studying a university, have this kind of sense of connecting with the broader society, you know, for historical reasons, for the role that Beijing University had always played in China.
But I understand that when you were looking at law school, I mean, in part, you weren't really that sure about what people did at law school. Is that right?
That's right. That was a learning process for me. That was, after I came, went to the University of Chicago, and law school is just across the midway. So it was 5 minutes from where I studied psychology, and it really gave me a chance to kind of know what law students are really doing and what lawyers are, you know, really could be, and make my decision.
Still then a pretty new discipline for someone just in from China, though.
Very much, very much. In fact, University of Chicago, in particular, at that time, I'm sure they have broadened their student body. But back then, they really don't have that many. Historically, they have had very few foreign students at all, let alone, you know, any Chinese students.
Rebecca, I look at your CV now, and I see that since that time you did legal work in New York's financial world of IPOs. You were the first back into China, one of the first to deal with privatization there, investment banking, media advice, and now international corporate law. You've been very, very busy. I'm wondering, where's home for you now? Do you consider yourself an American or Chinese? What do you think?
That's actually always a question on my mind. I don't know. Dick, I don't have a clear answer to that. And I travel so much, and I often wake up and I don't know where I am, which hotel I am in. But I would think hopefully I'm somewhere in between, in the sense that I hopefully what I do for a living, what I do at work is sort of providing a bridge between the two cultures.
There was a time when someone with your level of skills, bicultural and bilingual and understanding the law, was a pretty rare creature, and particularly a woman doing all that kind of work. Are there more people like you getting into at this level now?
Oh, yeah. I think the past 5 to 10 years, things have changed dramatically. You know, the level of sophistication in the professional world in China, you know, all the lawyers, bankers, and everybody else, it's just mind-boggling how different it is now from just 5 years ago.
Well, it's great to have you with us on the program. I'm going to ask you to just sit tight for a minute while we introduce our second guest. Xiaoyu Wang was born in Beijing, left China at a very early age, but has traveled frequently to and throughout the country. Most recently, Xiaoyu worked with an NGO based in rural China, and she's joining us today from a BBC studio in London, where she's studying at the London School of Economics. Xiaoyu, thank you so much for coming in. It's nice to have you with us.
My pleasure.
This work that you were doing with the NGO in Anhui Province, this was a little bit different from the kind of high-level business work that we hear so much about.
Certainly. Save the Children, that's the name of the NGO. They work with underprivileged children generally, AIDS people, children with AIDS, minority children, disabled children, delinquent children, and they kind of serve the communities throughout rural China, including Tibet and Yunnan. And I was in Anhui City, and we traveled into the rural countryside periodically to assess their programs.
So, were you surprised by what you saw on those trips?
It was incredibly provocative to me. I mean, I think since I had always returned to China as more or less of a tourist, you know, to see family and see more of the country. And it was just incredibly disillusioning to me, having kind of a much more rosy picture of China as a tourist. And then also, you know, reading the daily figures in the New York Times and, you know, listening to the generally very positive news around the world about China. It was incredibly disturbing to me.
Do you want to just give us one person, one place, one picture that you recall from that work that illustrates what it is you're talking about?
Sure. At one point, we went about 2 hours west of the city to visit a social welfare institute, and this includes, it's a place for children as well as aged people. And of course, our focus was on the children, but I think that in the major cities, the social welfare institutes are always in much better conditions. And it's really when you go into the countryside that you see the immense intra-regional disparities in China. And the conditions of the children, you know, they're one room schoolhouse kind of, you know, with just a single blackboard, you know, three or four little tables, and you know, these children are quite dirty and ill-fed, and there was no hope in their eyes, you know, and it was just incredibly saddening to me.
Is it easy, though, for you as a Chinese student, someone who's living now in London, to do that kind of work in the country now? Do you ever have, you or the people with the NGO, look over your shoulder to make sure you're not going to get in trouble with the government?
I think that SCUK is a very well-established NGO. I mean, it's been working since post-World War I. So I think they're, I mean, I never, you know, found any kind of censorship, you know, or anything like this. But perhaps for, you know, smaller NGOs that aren't so internationally well-known, they might encounter difficulty, certainly, because I think China's always had a, you know, kind of a publicity sort of campaign going for the country.
You have both, Rebecca and Xiaoyu, you know, been born in and traveled back and forth to China over the course of your lives. Do you even recognize the country? Rebecca, let me start with you on this. Do you even recognize the country where you were a student 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I certainly no longer can find my way around any of the cities in China and have to rely on basically taxis. China certainly has just changed tremendously. I still have the sense of continuity because I, you know, go back every few months. But if I were, you know, not going back for half a year or a year, I'm sure I would be shocked about, you know, all the changes.
How about you, Xiaoyu?
I think that every time I go back, the increasing sense of commercialism always astounds me. And in a certain way, the loss of characters that the cities are undergoing. I mean, in Beijing, for instance, because of the Olympics, I mean, they're really, you know, modernizing the city at an incredibly rapid pace. And a lot of the traditional one-story homes have been razed. And a lot of people, I mean, that was the essence of Beijing to many people. The little side streets, hutongs, where these buildings were located, so...
All right, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back after the break, a chance to include you in our conversation about the change, the remarkable change that's underway in China with two people who spend time working and living in that country, kind of urban modernization, what's not happening in rural China, and how it's really affecting the character of the country and the people who live there and what that means for Americans. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This is part of our special series, China's Century, as we take a look at the changes that are underway in China over the course of this week. We'll be looking at it from a lot of different perspectives. On this program, two people who make their living in part in China, who certainly understand that country, have seen the change by traveling in and out. Rebecca Lee is with us. She's just taken a new job at the Silicon Valley offices of O'Melveny & Myers Law Firm as a U.S.-based counsel, but as part of their China practice group, and is back and forth to China all the time. Xiaoyu Wang is also with us. She's studying development economics at the London School of Economics and spent last summer working with the UK Save the Children NGO. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Louisville, Kentucky, and Greg's with us. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. Tell me what you're thinking.
I'm curious about how you see that China growing so fast is going through the same sort of curve that other industrialized countries have gone through, and maybe now inheriting some of the social ills we've had to deal with. And one of the specific things I'm curious about is just the huge pressure it's going to put on the global energy system, how much more oil and everything China needs. And because this is happening on such a big scale, because China has so many people and is doing this so fast, can China even afford to, or are they looking at how much this puts pressure on, like, say, pollution, carbon emissions, all those sorts of things, or will China have to go through that same curve that we went through and not be able to address those things for two decades or whatever? Are they putting attention into that?
What's the pollution like in China now, Rebecca?
Oh, it's awful. It's when you take a flight and when the plane lands in Beijing, before it lands in Beijing airport, you basically have to go through this dark cloud of pollution, and it could be yellow, it could be dark depending on the day, but it's awful.
Do you see it in the rural areas as well, Xiaoyu?
Certainly in the rural areas there's more. Well, it's not so much industrial pollution as, for instance, when they're burning the crops at the end of the season.
Right.
You know, it kind of generates massive amounts of smoke. But I like to say that I find that there has been increasing environmental awareness in China, even in the smaller cities. When I traveled to another province this past summer called Shandong, even in small cities, newspapers, I was reading how they have been, you know, really trying to tackle the pollution problems and how they've, you know, made increasing progress in the past 5 years. So I was quite impressed with that.
Yeah, Rebecca, your perspective on that, and that's the other part of Greg's question, is the growth, is the change happening so quickly that people barely have the time to pause and ask themselves these questions about where are we going and what are we doing to ourselves as we get there?
I know it's definitely a question that's gladly it's on the one of the top priorities for the government. The energy issue is a big issue. China now consumes, you know, enormous amount of oil and every other sorts of energy, and it's a big importer. It has definitely a huge impact on the global energy market. Domestically, the growth rate has had a huge impact on everybody's daily life. You know, factory would be short of electricity. Homes would be short of electricity. This happens across the country. But I think the leadership in that country has taken steps to address it. But it's going to be a slow process.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join our conversation as we begin our series on China's century. Let's go next to Charlottesville, Virginia. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff.
I wonder if you could describe the kind of way that business is organized in China. For instance, here in the States and Western culture, we have the corporation, which has its various characteristics and ties to the government through different agencies and so forth. And I wonder what form that takes in China, especially in the way that might regard its combination with the state and the state's affairs.
Well, Rebecca, this is something that – yeah, thanks, Jeff. Rebecca, this is something that's brand new, the whole gamut of laws and regulations.
That's right. The corporate law in China called the company law was put into effect really not too long ago, just only a few years ago. Before that, before the 90s, up to the late 70s, early 80s, China was completely a so-called planned economy. Everything was owned by the state and run by the state. And gradually, in the past 10 years of reform, the government has taken steps to privatize a lot of the companies, and with the passing of the new laws, there have been, you know, all these forms of corporations similar to what we have here in the States developed in China, and you see more and more private enterprises organized the same way as companies here in the States do. You know, they have board of directors, they have the general corporate structures that the companies here do. So a lot of things are getting a lot similar to what you have in this country. And that, in fact, is in part a result of China taking a lot of the things in the U.S. as a model as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Again, from the people's perspective, Xiaoyu, maybe you can help me with this. You've got family that has lived consistently in China. Is that right?
Yes, on both sides of my family.
And what are they making of all this? Are they getting into business? Are they you know, looking at the stock market? How are they looking at all this?
Well, I know that my grandfather is certainly a player in the stock market, and when I went back to Beijing to visit him every day, he'd go and check up on his stocks at the local stock exchange, or I guess the Beijing Stock Exchange, you would say. And as for my aunt, she lives in Shenyang, which is one of the largest industrialized cities in the Northeast. And she's kind of, I think, maybe one of the typical, like, entrepreneurial class that's rising there. I mean, she has her own company. And every time I go back, she's relocated to a, you know, a bigger space and has more employees. And so I think, you know, generally, just like everyone else, my relatives are really taking advantage of the financial and industrial and other sectoral developments.
And so if we were to sit them all down at a family reunion and say, is this kind of economic change a good thing, a great thing for the country, what would they say?
I think that they would certainly be thrilled because they're part of the rising middle class, but I wouldn't say that for, you know, the 60% of the Chinese people who do live in the countryside who aren't so... I don't know, don't have so many opportunities as they do in the cities. They perhaps wouldn't have the same point of view.
Yeah, Rebecca, I saw something in the opening address of President Hu Jintao at the National People's Congress on the weekend, a promise to eliminate a tax on peasants that's been in place for hundreds and hundreds of years. Is that kind of move symbolic, or do you think that there is anybody starting to balance out who are the winners and who are the losers in this changing economy?
Well, it's a tough question. I think this generation of leaders have put a very clear priority on raising the living standard of the people in the rural sites, because over the past 10 years, the gap between the so-called the riches of China and the poor of China has become so large, and it's very, very troubling. So I think what you just mentioned is just very, very symbolic of what the leaders have in mind.
Do you ever get a chance, Rebecca, to take a look at the students at Beijing University and look at their lives today, compare that to your life when you were a student there in the late 80s and the early 90s?
Oh, I think the students these days are a lot more, they are not more sophisticated than we were back then, in part because the societies that they live in these days are so different from, what we had before. A lot of my classmates are here in the state, in the U.S.,
right,
studying or working, but a lot of them also have, they chose to stay in China and became very successful entrepreneurs. And the big change between the students now and our lives back then is that now every student graduating from college is no longer guaranteed a job. So everybody has to really plan their future in the earlier years instead of waiting just for the party or the government to sign them a position.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join my conversation this hour with two people who have a very close eye on the change that's underway in China now. I'm wondering if you would both go so far as to say that the kind of economic growth that country is going through now is in any fundamental way changing the character of the people who live there. What do you think? Xiaoyu, do you want to start on that?
Sure. I think that because of the speed of the change that China is undergoing right now, there's just an increasing kind of obsession of self-improvement and, bettering you and your immediate family members. Perhaps this is a cultural aspect of China as well. But for me, what's disturbing walking on the street is just I think the increasing lack of community and there's no sense of civic awareness or awareness of, the hardships that other people are encountering and, that's going on in the countryside. Even if you're living, as a city so close to the countryside, there's just an apathy generally. And that disturbs me a lot because people are so concentrated on their own, bettering their own lives. So
what do you think, Rebecca?
I think I tend to agree with what Xiaoyu just mentioned. I think people, if you go to the country, you feel, whether as a tourist or as a native of China, like me, returning to the country, you feel everybody around you is so incredibly driven, and by different things. Some by, their own, as Xiaoyu said, self-well-beings. But I've also seeing a lot more and more people who, like Xiaoyu, is doing a lot of things to for the rest of the society, for other people. So I think I see there's people are still right now in this transition stage. Everybody is transitioning from the old China to the new China, but I think I've seen this trend of balancing out a lot of these changes, and I think hopefully eventually things will become a lot more, like what we hope it would be.
I'm just wondering, though, Rebecca, when you describe this drive to succeed, the people, reaching out for material goods, is it any different from what we would describe the United States to be like?
Well, I think you can feel maybe because depending on your expectation, sometimes you feel that the level of hunger is more intense than what you see people here. You see, you already have a huge middle class in the U.S.
Right.
In China, everybody is trying to become a member of the middle class. So I think the urgency is, it's in China, it's like if you don't hurry, you'll be left behind.
The extremes then, Xiaoyu, are much greater as you see them?
Oh, certainly. I mean, this might be a little bit of a radical comment, but I feel that if there is one religion in China, I mean, that would center around money. I mean, everything is focused on money. And it's never out of sight, out of mind when you're traveling in the country, whether you're in the countryside or in the cities. I mean, it becomes a little overwhelming. Yeah.
1-800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Mount Vernon, Iowa. Carla's joining us. Hi, Carla.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Good. I have actually a two-part question. Not long ago, there was a show on NPR that I listened to about the workforce in China and the percentage of prisoners and or political prisoners that are used in the workforce. I'm wondering, do you know what that percentage is? And secondly, are there any discussions at this point in terms of workers' rights, in terms of globalization, and I know some kind of equity in global workers' rights.
Carla, let's divide the question if we can, and get Xiaoyu to help us with the first part in terms of to what extent are political prisoners or prisoners a part of the Chinese workforce today.
Oh, geez, I wouldn't know the statistical.
That's right. We're not looking for numbers. Is it just something that is known or not known, talked about, not talked about?
Certainly not talked about. I think just as our perception of China is incredibly positive in the West, the perception of China in China is generally positive in the media and in the news. And
that's state-sponsored media and news, though, right?
Exactly. So the people certainly wouldn't be aware of these kind of inequalities or injustices.
What about workers' rights, Rebecca? How much is known about that now?
I think now it's actually becoming something real. And in the past, everybody was just working for the party. So everybody, you don't need a right. You don't need to demand your own right to work for the party. But now unemployment is a huge issue in China with all this state enterprise reforms going on. You know, when a company goes private, goes public, it needs to really become more efficient. And in China, you have enormous amount of workers. And in the past, historically, the Chinese companies have really just, really was operated like you know, the city of Palo Alto. They have their clinics, they have their all the social activities sponsored by the company. Everything was taken care of by the company. But as a commercial entity, it can't be like that. So unemployment is a huge issue, and demonstrations, a lot of these people laid off, they have to find a way to support their family. It's a huge issue for the individual workers. It's also a huge issue for the government.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join my conversation this hour. Rebecca Lee is with us from Palo Alto, California, and Xiaoyu Wang is joining us from the BBC studios in London, where she's studying at the London School of Economics. I wonder if, Xiaoyu, in your life as a student in London, you find yourself often trying to re-explain China to people who spend too much time looking at The Economist magazine or other publications.
You'd be surprised. The LSE is actually, we have a China Development Society, and there's actually various development societies, and there's always venues and public lectures in which, China being a focal point of many of them, there's discussions and debate. So I think generally at the LSE, kids are pretty well informed. Of course, it is more biased toward the economic growth of the topic, but right. It is a London School of Economics and Political Science, so we are a little more well-rounded.
You do get to talk about those things. And I hope that when we come back after the break, we'll have a chance to include more of our listeners in that conversation. Just a reminder, our number is 1-800-423-8255 as part of our series China's century, an opportunity to talk with two people who are living that century right now and looking at its effects, both the opportunities and the contradictions that are a part of China today, and what the short-term or the long-term implications of those will be for both the people living there, people living here. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. So, after all those years of social upheaval, revolution, socialism, now capitalism, what's that done to the lives of ordinary people in China? And as capitalism grows at the pace that it's growing, what kind of other changes is it going to bring to that country? And what will those changes mean for people who are living outside the country? Your chance to join us this hour at 1-800-423-8255 to Clarksville, Virginia. And Russell's with us. Hi, Russell.
Hi.
Thank you for calling. What do you think?
Thanks for taking my call. This is incredibly upsetting to me because, you know, as a consumer, most of the things that I buy when I go into a store, I read labels, and most of the stuff that I buy today is now made in China, but yet it's an American name on the product, and
yeah.
It really upsets me that it's not, you know, it should be a Chinese, you know, name on there, not an American name, because, you know, most of my friends, you know, have lost their jobs to these companies that have gone over to. If you drive around Clarksville and South Boston and all these areas and you see all the factories that have shut down, but yet the CEOs and all the executives still have their jobs, but yet all of us little people don't have a job.
Who do you blame for that, Russell? Who do you blame for that?
I blame the CEOs and greed and the opportunity to get things done cheaper. They don't want to, you know. We all lost our jobs. We can still produce.
Yeah, you're not saying it's necessarily the fault of the Chinese then that this is happening?
No, I'm definitely not angry at the Chinese. It's an opportunity that they.
I think we've lost that line, Russell. Your cell was just fading out on us there, and you know, there's a part of that I'd love to hear both Rebecca and Xiaoyu talk just a bit about, and that is, I mean. We hear this anger, you know, and it's sometimes it's directed towards the CEOs, sometimes it's directed specifically towards China and the Chinese government. And I'm wondering, as Chinese, when you hear your country described as this big threat, what is it? What does that mean to you? Rebecca, do you want to start?
I think about this sometimes, and I think if I put myself in the shoes of the workers in the States who, you know, just lost a job yesterday because the factory was closed down and the jobs moved to China, I probably would feel the same way. So in a sense, if the position of, you know, the U.S. and China switched and all the jobs in China went to U.S., mm-hmm. I, as a Chinese, I would feel sometimes that kind of emotion toward the U.S. too. So I think it's completely legitimate and reasonable for people to feel this frustration. But the solution, unfortunately, is going to be a difficult one. And, you know, obviously we hear these debates in the U.S. and in China all the time. And also from the perspective of the people in China, there's also this interesting kind of evolution or change. At the beginning, the Chinese always felt that the U.S. Investors came to the country to take advantage of them. Hmm. They were always very cautious. They always thought anything they do with the foreigners, you know, is basically going to be something that there's always something going on in the background that they would not know. But, you know, gradually with their self-confidence increasing, with their level of sophistication increasing, I think they now see things a lot more rationally, and a lot of the joint ventures or corporations down in China nowadays are seen really as a way to benefit mutual parties.
So when you're at a business meeting and listening to the Chinese businessmen talk about the opportunities that they have to make money, whether or not it's exporting products to Europe or to the United States, is there at the table any kind of a resentment about why, you know, what? How could the U.S. possibly complain about us doing what they've been doing for years and years, and that is to be good capitalists?
You hear that all the time. And, you know, the Chinese are very, very competitive people, and they want to become a big economy. But they also have always, truly, truly believed in peaceful the big term coexistence. But I think right now on the mind of ordinary Chinese people on a day-to-day basis, it's really very simple. It's just to make their life a better, make the life of their loved one better than before.
Xiaoyu, how do you hear that conversation about America when you get involved in it in China?
I suppose I see it from a rather economic point of view. I just see it in terms of comparative advantage. I mean, China has a large, relatively low-skilled labor force, and it makes a lot of sense to me that, you know, there's a lot of jobs of that nature that are being outsourced to China.
And do the people in the countryside, the migrant workers who go into the city to take those jobs, do they see themselves as being exploited? Do they see it as their leg up into the middle class? Is there any resentment at that level?
Oh, I think that certainly that there is. I mean, the Chinese are incredibly driven people, as Rebecca was saying, and I don't think there's resentment, but there's certainly it's not a completely hopeful process, I would say, because they are very unskilled compared to people who do live in the city and the opportunities open to them. So even though they are traveling into the city, I mean, what they're really doing is kind of opening little kiosks and, you know, selling cigarettes or something. And it doesn't really bear much hope, you know, of any kind of real social or welfare improvement for themselves.
Let's go to Kingston, Rhode Island. Michael's joining us on the phone from there. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, Dick. For your two guests, for Rebecca, and I apologize, I don't recall her.
Xiaoyu is her name.
Xiaoyu. Do either of you see, is this transformation that China is now underway with, is this the era of, is the cradle-to-grave era for healthcare, free education, and a guaranteed job? Is that long-held socialist system now over, if it's not completely over, is it in its death throes? And very quickly also, do either of you see the era of free speech? I think that China is capitalist in all but name, from my perspective here in the West. Do either of you anticipate that within a generation you will both be able to experience the kind of freedoms, the free speech kind of freedoms that we in America here or in the West take for granted?
Oh, boy, a lot on the table there. But let me, if I can, start with Xiaoyu just on that question of social guarantees, healthcare, education, social welfare. I mean, Michael's quite right in saying that that was one of the promises, the guarantees of socialism. Where is it now?
Certainly, I look to the government and I don't see it. In terms of healthcare, pension, unemployment benefits, I mean, social welfare at large, I mean, the social net is, I mean, if even existent, it's you know, barely existent, I think, in China. I think the government is taking, you know, advantage of capitalism in the sense that they're privatizing a lot of the former state-owned industries. You know, there's just mass privatization, and they're kind of putting pensions and healthcare in the hands of the private companies who are still, you know, in their infancy, and they don't have the means to take care of this yet. And like looking at the unemployed masses in the streets in the smaller cities in China, it is, you know, sorely evident that there's not enough of a social net out there.
Well, you were talking about your aunt and how she's, you know, looking at different ways to build a business, improve her life. Does anybody say to her, you know, you really need to do something to provide some kind of advantage for your workers, whether it's in healthcare or food or childcare or anything like that? Or does that exist?
She might have a particular relationship to her workers because they most of them have been working for her for quite a long time. And she's taken them under her wing more or less and, you know, do care for them. But there's, you know, there's no formalized system.
Yeah, and Rebecca, what about that? The sort of legal obligations that the private companies have to replace all these parts of the social welfare system which don't exist anymore.
It's very much still in transition, because as you know, we talked about the government is trying to really privatize a lot of these things, a lot of these social welfares, healthcare, social security. These are all the items that are on the table, and there are some preliminary steps being taken. You know, there's a committee established to oversee the use and the you know, the network for social security, how to invest that money, how to require private citizens invest in that pool and all that. So it's very preliminary. But the in terms of the private companies, it's a lot of the cases, if it's a completely privately owned company, it's really the contractual relationship between mm-hmm. the company and the workers. But it's very, most of the cases, they are very minimum and they don't meet the workers' requirements.
Michael, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Is that the part about the social welfare question that you were looking for?
Yes, I think pretty much so, Dick. We have, most of us, I know that we're all of relatively the same age bracket, give or take a few years. We grew up with a communist power, and I have viewed China for the longest time as I have with Cuba. I think that there are some positive traits to the socialist creed. Although I'm a capitalist, there are the experiences that people have had. I'm sure it is such a radical transformation mm-hmm. that I'm wondering. I think the natural assumption is there must be great angst within a country of 1.5 billion people going through this transformation. Your two guests seem to be highly educated, very, very intelligent people. They have made this transformation. However, I know that the peasants, I have to assume that the peasants and those laboring in Shanghai and Beijing feel a great sense of unease. And I'm just wondering, will it take more than a generation before China is somewhat stable through the end of this transformation?
No, it's a great question, because while we talk about the people trying to get their way into to a middle class and people trying to get into that middle class, that those questions about the angst of the people, or the unease about people, is it going to work? Will my children get anything from this? Rebecca, how much of that do you hear, even in the cities?
Well, I think there's actually in a conference not too long ago, one of the speakers was a senior advisor to the government, and he made this statement. He said, in China, any advantage that China has, if you magnify it by 1 billion, it's going to be a huge advantage. But at the same time, any problem that China has, if you magnify it by the same 1 billion, it's going to be a huge problem. And of course, that 1 billion refers to the population.
Yeah.
So, and healthcare is a clear example of that. I don't know how long it's going to take for China to build up a reasonably acceptable safe net. I think a generation or two generations, we don't know, but I think you know, it's a huge issue. Even in the U.S., such a well-developed country, you still have now to tackle the social mm-hmm. security problem. In China, it's probably going to take a lot longer.
So you in Shandong, in Anhui, the people there who aren't necessarily a part of all the economic booming that's going on in the country, is there fear there about what's ahead for them or their children?
I don't think there's so much fear as they just kind of accept it as the way their life is, in the sense that it's a fight for themselves and they can't depend on anyone else, and certainly not the government. And, you know, only perhaps their families. There's always been a very immensely strong family network in China, you know. And that's why there's such a drive, you know, for your children, you know, for the next generation to be better than yourselves, and therefore, you know, take care of the older generation. And I think that's all that they can depend on.
Time for a call from Sherborne, Massachusetts. Renato is with us. Hi, Renato.
Hi, how you doing, Dick? Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate that. I was just wondering, It obviously, China has achieved a lot in this last few decades. But it seems to me that the women still being treated in a different way from the male, for instance. And I was wondering if your guest has any comments to make about that, because it's almost like countries in the Middle East where women has less chances. I was reading a magazine, and on this magazine they were saying that when a woman is pregnant and when they go to a doctor for an ultrasound, they would not tell if it's a male or a female, because it tends to have a lot of abortions going towards the female child.
You know what I want to do, Renato? I want to take the first part of your question about just how easy it is to work and make your way in China as a woman today, because I think we have two people who know a little something about that. Xiaoyu, you want to start with us on that? When you're working, does anybody give you any less respect because you're a woman?
Oh, certainly not. I suppose it's because I was working in an NGO, but most of them were in my office were actually women.
Yeah.
Granted, the head was actually a man. But I think one thing that socialism or communism had going for it was the fact that it mobilized the female labor force. And so I think that some semblance of equality, you know, is established in the minds of the population in terms of working.
So easier for you, Rebecca, as a woman in China than maybe even as a woman lawyer in the U.S.? I don't know.
It's hard to say. You know, I definitely have had some really bad experiences in China, but I've also had very positive experiences as well. So it's kind of very much case-by-case basis. What China does not have is the legal guarantee or the legal framework that you have in the States about this equality, about, for example, you know, sexual harassment and all these prohibitions. So in China, it's they have not come to that stage yet. But historically, the Communist Party has tried to make it clear that, you know, women should be treated equally. But in terms of legal guarantee, it's not in place yet.
Well, there's something for a lawyer working in China to work on that.
Absolutely.
Listen, I want to thank both of you for helping us out on the program today, giving us this personal insight into what's happening in the country. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Dick.
Rebecca Lee is a lawyer with the Silicon Valley offices, O'Melveny and Myers. And Xiaoyu Wang, I want to thank you for coming in as well.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Xiaoyu is a student at the London School of Economics. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenelosa, Pamela Ferdinand, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Help from Sarah Baker, Annie Hopengarten, and Patrick Kiker. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.